Hello and welcome to this week's episode of House of Comments. My name is Emma Burnell and I am a political journalist, and I'm joined as always by Nick Dennis of the Tory Workers Group. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Emma.
And Mark Thompson, who is a political commentator and blogger. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
You both sort of seem to pause slightly after I described you there. I'm sure I'm not containing your multitudes, but I've only got a tiny amount of time for these introductions.
Emma, I'm loads of different people. So, I mean, I can list them all if you want.
Emma, I think you should use a different description each time to cover the whole sort of multiple brilliance of my personality. So I look forward to how you describe me next time.
So next time when I go for Dawson lookalike, you won't be upset.
Well, listeners will have to wait and find out, won't they?
Great stuff. Okay, so from the sublime to the ridiculous, there's no money left in local government. What a surprise. Local government has only been saying this would have happened I was working for a local government think tank 5 years ago. We were certainly saying it then. Northamptonshire has been the first big domino to fall. They are running out of money. They are not able to fund essential services going forward, and they may, they may go bust. That's where we are. There are other councils who are close to that. We know that, but we don't know exactly who they are yet. And obviously, there's been quite a lot of tension between different groups of people deciding whose fault this is. Nick, whose fault is this?
George Osborne's. To put it bluntly, obviously
you won't let me disagree with you, Nick, which will make for a dull podcast.
I mean, so when austerity first happened, or when the crash first happened, and the coalition government was elected in 2010, and it was decided that state spending was too much and had to be cut back, and of course, you know, there were definitely things that had to be cut back, and the level of state spending did have to be cut back. I remember at the time, George Osborne was pretty keen on the Canadian model, shall we say. Canadian model, Norwegian models, they all seem to be very fashionable again, but this was a different Canadian model, where in order for them to balance the books, essentially Canada gave its regional government, its provinces, more responsibility, less money and more responsibility to find savings. Now, at the time, I thought to myself, well, that doesn't really work, not in the UK system, where it's highly centralised and local government relies extremely heavily on the grants that they get from central governments. So, I'm a local councillor in Hillingdon, and I've actually just come from a group meeting where we discussed basically the budget that we're going to put down in a couple of weeks' time. And because we're a very well managed and run council, we are, you know, we're actually in okay shape and we're doing pretty well. But I mean, that's partly because we've got a fantastic leader who is an accountant, I would say ex-accountant, but still an accountant, and been leader for 10 years and is able to sort of manage the money in these very difficult times. But one thing I have noticed as a local councillor is the cuts keep on coming and coming, and they're coming in a form which is less obvious than previous cuts. So, for example, this might sound small, but if you add up all the small things, it matters. The police, for Remembrance Sunday, and the police, you know, obviously shut some roads for us. We have like 11 or 12 different events in my borough, and they used to just do that for us. From last year, they actually started charging us for it, and you're getting a lot of these different things where actually more and more costs are being put onto local governments, who have less money to spend and more responsibilities, so something's got to give.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that, I think what's really interesting is there have been some areas where spend has increased, but it's been not enough to make up for all the areas that put pressure on those areas. So you can say, oh, spending on social care has gone up in real terms. Yes and no, Lord Copper, because actually the extra pressure on things like children's mental health services that are caused by increases in insecurity, increases in housing insecurity and work insecurity, in educational insecurity, are increasing the number of people in need of those services to a greater extent than the increase of funding that goes into them. So you're right that it's not just the big ticket cuts that we've seen, that we saw during the coalition years, but the constant pressure that, first of all, those cuts are put onto other services and pushed into other services. And also the fact that there just isn't the leeway for any of the services to pick that up anymore. So, yeah, I mean, housing departments are completely under pressure. And Indeed. The pressure that they're under knocks into the social services department, for example. So it's an incredible... And what... If George Osborne had been serious about a Canadian model, he would have not just changed the relationship between central and local government, which needs massive reform, but also would have had the guts at the beginning of the coalition years, when he had the power and the capacity to do it, when we were a post-crash, so we needed radicalism, to reform how councils are funded. And, you know, council tax is just so not fit for purpose anymore. It's a ridiculous system based on the values of people's houses. In 1991, I was 16 in 1991. The idea that we live in the same world where I was dancing to the Pixies three times a week in clubs is just a bit bonkers. And so we need to look again at local government finance. Now, there are going to be different ideas of different models. I think there'll probably be quite a strong left-right split about how that's done. But I think most people in local government agree that council tax, whatever you might want to replace it with, is no longer fit for purpose. Mark, what's your take on this?
Well, similar to what both of you have said, I mean, I was going to mention about the council tax thing and not having been, you know, updated since 1991, and that's just political cowardice. That's that.
Yeah.
And after what happened with the poll tax and the riots and everything, and the community charge was abolished, and council tax was brought in, and no government since then of any stripe has been willing to touch this. It's like almost the ultimate third rail issue, in that you know, the people who lose out are going to scream the loudest, and the people who are going to lose out the most are going to be the ones with the most expensive houses and therefore the most political influence. So,
yeah, we saw that with the mansion tax.
Yeah, I mean, I could quite honestly see that we'll get another, what are we now, 27 years on from 1991. I think we could get another 27 years on from now and still be left with the valuations from 1991 and still have the council tax system the way it is. I mean, maybe what we're seeing happening now will force the government or a government's hand on this, because if it reminds me of the song in Les Mis, you know, here a little slice, there a little cut, and you know, you can get away with it for a while, little slices here, little cuts there, but eventually, as Nick said, they add up, and eventually it becomes unsustainable. And it's very easy for a chancellor to stand at the dispatch box and say, there's going to be this cut and that cut to local governments. And we're going to, we're going to force local governments to ring fence this thing and that thing, but then not increase the funding in any way. And therefore kind of offload stuff that was previously provided by central government to local government and not increase the grants. And also legislate to not allow local council areas to increase the council tax by anything like the kind of amounts that they would need to. And I've been watching this going on for years, and I've been wondering when it was all going to come crashing down, and we're starting to see it now. And it's such a kind of fool's errand to do this, because ultimately, if Northamptonshire Council collapses, what's going to happen? You're not just going to have a situation where, like, the people in Northamptonshire aren't going to get their council services. They'll still get them. It's just they'll have to be done in another way, maybe by, I don't know, is another council going to take over? They're going to bring a team in? I don't know, but it'll have to be paid for somehow by taxation, whether it's local taxation, central taxation. You can't just have hundreds of thousands of people who don't get the services. It's ridiculous.
No, I mean, I think, as a guess, Em might know more about this. I think what will happen in Northampton, if it does sort of fall over, is a team will come in and make decisions about what should and shouldn't happen. And they won't be democratically accountable. So they may make cuts in certain areas, which they shouldn't make cuts in. You know, something else that happened this week was Westminster Council sending out begging letters, basically, to their richer residents saying, can you pay some more council tax to help fund our services? You know, that's just terrible. That's disgraceful. We shouldn't be having to do that. Councils shouldn't be having to do that. I think it's, you know, if Westminster, you know, Westminster are lucky enough in the sense that they have a lot of very rich residents who they can write to. Most councils aren't in that position.
But I think, you know, I think that's showing you how sort of desperate the system is becoming. Of course, when the coalition government came in 2010, they brought in the Localism Act, which was meant to sort of try and rebalance that power, sort of. But obviously, you know, the centre always finds it very difficult to give power away, you see. So, yeah, it didn't go as far as it should do.
My memory, if memory serves, the Localism Act gave the Secretary of State for Communities and Local Government 42 powers that had previously sat within local government. It was slightly oddly named.
I mean, that sounds about right. You have this crazy situation, for example, where obviously you have academy schools, for example, which are sort of independent, really, from local authorities. But obviously, schooling is a massive issue within the local authority area. Yeah. So we can't really do much about academies. But you know, we can do stuff about our own schools, but not academies. But what Ofsted have actually now done is they've set up sort of regional groups to sort of make academies more accountable to the areas they're in. And I'm sort of sitting there thinking, well, why do you just let local authorities be, you know, be the elected officials be in charge? There's this funny sort of thing going on where things are cut up and taken away and given to somebody else, another quango, and it is all a big mess, really. But I think the truth is that this is a general broad truth, and especially because of Brexit and the fact that we're recasting our whole sort of way we operate. We should be, but you know, where we are or not is another matter. You know, is spending cuts have to end, a pause has to happen, and then all the consideration of how to pay for local authority spending and what local authorities should do should be reformed. But you have to pause the cuts in order to make it, in order to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the problem is that local authority financial reform got tied in to the cuts. It was very much seen as, and certainly was to an extent, a very ideological project about shrinking the state. The reason... ostensibly for austerity was the crash, but there were other ways, more conventional economic ways, Keynesian ways, to deal with the post-crash environment. It didn't have to be about turning the taps off. Many would argue that that was exactly the wrong time to turn the taps off. So it was an ideological choice to shrink the state. It was supposed to be a long-term choice, but the argument for shrinking the state was never actually made. No one ever said, you should have fewer services. Yeah, you know, that was never made explicit.
I think it actually was, Emma. I think it was. I mean, firstly, I don't think ideology is a bad thing. It's the soul in politics, and
people, I don't think people, it's a bad thing at all.
And people on the left often use ideology as a stick to bash conservatives with, but because they sort of see their own ideology as not being an ideology, but the right way. But I think at the time the long term economic plan narrative was all about essentially cutting back waste. Spending less money on the state, people having, you know, in order to have a strong economy, better jobs. So I think it was sort of communicated.
Yeah, but I think that what you think is waste and what other people think is waste is not necessarily the same thing. That's what I mean. The argument was we will cut waste, not we will cut services, because we believe there should be fewer services delivered by the state.
I think waste has been cut. I mean, I think it's come to its limit now, but I think the fact it hasn't started creaking until now shows that actually the savings could have been made.
Well, I mean, I think we can disagree over whether it's creaking now, whether the creaks were the warning shots we should have heard a few years ago before it started to fall into the sea.
So, Mark, as our independent middle way third rail guy, what do you think?
I sort of agree a bit with Emma that I think the cuts probably did start having quite a negative effect a few years back. But you know what happens? You know, people make do, and you know, you find ways around the problems, and people kind of adjust a little bit. But eventually, you come up against a kind of a hard wall, and that's obviously where Northamptonshire have got to. And what I'm worried about is, I think that is the canary in the coal mine, and I think that many more will fall. If Northamptonshire does fall, I think there are many more that are probably pretty close to the wall, and we'll see that happen if they don't do something quite quickly. And that's what really worries me about this, because, you know, what happens then? You said about you send a team in. Well, the team isn't just going to arrive from outer space. That team will cost money, and that's money that's then being wasted. I mean, talk about cutting waste, and I agree. I think there was quite a lot of fat in local government services. You know, anyone who's ever had any dealings with local government knows that they are not run in the most efficient possible way. However, you know, where are all these teams going to come from if all of these councils start to fail? And that's just going to cost lots of money. And it doesn't seem efficient. It really feels like this thing you actually have across government, which is the different silos do different things. They don't talk to each other and the things are duplicated and they just want to keep things tidy in their silo, even if it negatively affects another silo. And I think you'll have the same sort of thing going on here, where they'll just sort out one problem at a time in different local government areas, when actually what they need to do is take 5 steps back from this and think, hang on a minute, this thing is completely dysfunctional now. What have we done wrong? What do we need to do to get this back on track?
I mean, it's important to mention that the bad choices must have been made in the Northamptonshire model and other models as well. I mean, so obviously I know a lot about my own area, and there is a story that which I really like to sort of tell to sort of show how sort of a conservative local authority and also local authority can act in the interests of its residents and save money. I mean, so when austerity first started hitting, obviously it was quite fashionable to outsource services. Now, we in Hillingdon, we still have a weekly sort of all waste, you know, bin, garden waste, recycling waste, every single week picked up. And the reason why we do that is because it's very important to all our residents. And when the cuts first started happening, all this outsourcing started happening, the leader went to the, the depot where all the bin men were, and there's two things that bin men are really interested in. It's it's their wages and the breaks that they can have, and that's fair enough, because it's obviously it's not the most satisfying job, apart from, even though you get very fit if you go on a bin round. I once went on a bin round. It's very knackering work. And so somebody said to him, are you going to outsource us? And Lee said, I don't want to outsource you, because you're a really important service to our residents. I want to carry on running you in-house, and I still want to carry on doing weekly services. I'm going to have to make some changes in order for that to happen. But if you're happy to make those changes with you and we carry on delivering this good service, then I'm not going to outsource you. And as I sit here now, you know, he did this in 2010, our sort of bin services, all our waste services are still in-house. And he worked, you know, with the unions, with the staff, in order to, you know, cut costs, but still run a very good service. So I think some councils, and I'm not going to say names, I don't know particularly, basically, I think, panicked and too easily signed up to bad outsourcing projects and didn't think about how to actually manage the services themselves. So and then you get to situations where, for example, I don't know the details of Surrey and Northampton, but I'm sure not all the brilliant decisions were made to put
I mean, my understanding, one of the things that Northampton did was continue to hold down council tax against advice that precisely this would happen. But I completely agree with you about the outsourcing question. I wrote an article about outsourcing and ideology and procurement are all of these things. I don't think that outsourcing in and of itself has to be a bad thing. It's like all of these things. I don't think that zero-hour contracts have to be a bad thing, having been a recipient of a really good one. The problem is when they are used by unscrupulous people with greater resources and power than you have to screw you over, you get screwed over. And so there are some very, very bad contracts out there, or there are some contracts that are written in such ways that leave councils so much worse off. Councils of all stripes, councils of all colours, councils of all sizes. And this is the problem. And then we get into it becomes then a necessarily ideological battle, because you get this sense that, oh, well, pragmatists outsource and ideologues don't. Well, you've just proven that doesn't have to be the case, because that would be a battle within the Labour Party normally. But you have said, as a Conservative councillor, how proud you were that you kept your services in-house. So, you know, that for you was a pragmatic decision.
It was focusing on what was best for our residents. So we do outsource some stuff, of course, and we don't outsource some other stuff. But every single judgment is made on, you know, what can we do that you know, makes our council tax go further, for example. So, pragmatism is the way forward.
Well, I don't think there's necessarily, the setup that the anger I have is this this idea that you're either ideological or you're pragmatic, whereas actually, surely the best point is to find the ideology and that works for you and for the people that elect you, and then find pragmatic ways to implement that. And that there are going to be different pragmatic solutions depending on what your ideological bent is. But that doesn't mean that ideology is the enemy of pragmatism or vice versa. You know, there are perfectly valid ways of having a difference about in opinion about the size and purpose of the state without either side of that being either unpragmatic or too pragmatic. Yeah, no, I agree.
In my example, what we didn't do is just shout at the government, moan at the government, and spend money on adverts slacking off the government, then have forced to cut services because we run out of money. What we did is we actually sort of said to the staff in that area, in the waste disposal area, you know, work with us. We have to make efficiencies, but let's do it together and we can do it. So we were, you know, we were driven by ideology as well, but we were pragmatic in that. So, you know, and ultimately, that's the best way of getting the best deals. I mean, if you rely just on ideology, it's quite lazy, actually, because relying just on ideology means you don't have to do the
hard work.
You
should be informed by the ideology that you stand on. You and I might have, we'll come at things from very, very different angles. We might end up with the same solution, which we probably would have done given the way where you are with your bin men. But that doesn't mean that we haven't gone through important and very different thought processes to get there. So, I mean, I think we're agreeing a bit too much on local government. I'm not sure that they're quite bringing the fireworks. And Mark, you're just staying very quiet.
Well, I don't have the experience that Nick does in local government. I tried to get elected. It didn't work. So I don't have the direct experience.
Yeah, I like to think I have more experience. I did 3 years with the whole of local government. Nick's just got one little council.
Yeah, exactly.
we're not little. We've got a budget of about a billion, just turn over about £1 billion a year. But,
typical man, but, you just couldn't but, take but, being called little.
But I do agree, I mean, you've got a very wide perspective, which is very good and important in this debate, even if your ideology slightly colours what you say.
As does yours, my darling. Okay, so I think we should probably move on to the next topic, which is the enemy of the people. This week's enemy of the people, or possibly last week's enemy of the people. So we have seen front pages of the Telegraph and the following day, the Daily Mail, attacking George Soros in terms that can only be described, and I think we probably all agree on this, as extremely troubling. The language used echoed conspiracy theories that have been propounded about George Soros in places like Hungary that are profoundly anti-Semitic. And that's something that, you know, as you both know, I've put my neck out and attacked that in the Labour Party and on the left all the time. And, you know, having done that to my own party, I'm not going to let the Telegraph or the Mail get away with it. And I'm sure that you both agree with that. But is there anything that can be said? You know, did they have any point at all in terms of the attack on George Soros' secret funding that we all know about to Open Britain? Mark, what's your take on this?
No, not really. I mean, it just seemed kind of ridiculous to me. Well, ridiculous is the wrong word because he's actually very sinister. But in terms of trying to look at any sort of substance that might be behind it, it's not secret. Everyone knows that George Soros has been putting money into this. And why shouldn't he? I mean, Rupert Murdoch has been running, you know, newspapers in this country for decades and massively influencing politics in this country, and most people on the right wing are fine with that because he's on their side. It's only when someone is doing that in a much, much, much less influential way, let's be honest, that suddenly it seems to be a big problem. But the anti-Semitic tropes that are being used, I mean, it is part and parcel of this thing that we are now seeing, and it's becoming more and more undeniable, surely, that Brexit and Trump have unleashed a very, very, very nasty strain in the politics of the West. And people who previously, and you know, journalists, I'm talking about journalists, but I'm also talking about, this is going all the way through society. You keep hearing stories time and again now of people being shouted at and spat at in the streets in ways that just, I'm not saying it never used to happen. Yes, it did used to happen. When I was a kid, you would hear about like skinheads going down the road and you know, racial abuse. But it now seems to be happening in situations where it just simply didn't before. It can't be because these people weren't racist before. They must have been. They just kept quiet about it. They've now been emboldened. They think that 52% of people in this country agree with them, agree that they should be shouting at people with different skin colours in the streets, that they should go home. And that is a little bit away from what we saw on the front cover of the Telegraph, but it's all part and parcel of the same thing. There's been a nasty coarsening of the debate and a reduction of the debate down to this kind of binary filter of you're either with us or you're against us. And, you know, Theresa May with her citizens of nowhere thing fed into that. And I am pretty fearful for where this is going to end up, because I'm not optimistic that Brexit will be good. I don't think it will be good. I voted Remain, so maybe I would say that, wouldn't I? But if I'm right, and if Brexit does pan out badly, it won't be the people who voted to leave won't blame themselves. They'll find further scapegoats. And instead of it being just the people who maybe came here in the last 5 or 10 years, it might be the people who came here 30 years ago. It might be the people whose parents came here 50 years ago. I really fear for where this is going, because we've already seen the dynamics of how this scapegoating goes. And I know I keep saying this, and I keep saying it and caveating it, that I don't think it will end up like it did in Germany in the 1930s. But we are seeing the same patterns and the same tropes played out here. Scapegoating minorities, blaming the Jews. I mean, it's actually happening. I now no longer wonder how Hitler came to power and how he came to be in the position he was eventually in 1939. I now no longer wonder about that, because I'm seeing patterns play out here that I don't think will go in that direction ultimately, and I really hope don't. But I wouldn't be totally shocked if we started to slide down in that direction now, given how far we've come already. And fundamentally, I don't think that the human race has changed that much in the last 90 years. We're not immune from it.
What's worrying me most is the mainstreaming of this kind of talk, this kind of behaviour. You don't just have a smaller paper like The Express. You know, this is the Telegraph and the Daily Mail. Telegraph used to be called, you know, the Tory sort of home paper. Now, I don't think most Tories were happy with that, although I think rather worryingly, the current leadership favourite, Jacob Rees-Mogg, was retweeting and tweeting about Soros in the same way, which was very disturbing. But what worries me is that there's this constant pushing of the norms, this constant moving of what is acceptable, this constant sort of edging further and further away from what we used to think were the norms. And, oh, well, it's just Jacob Rees-Mogg. Well, it used to be, oh, it's just Boris, and now he's Foreign Secretary. And I want to make this a non-partisan point. So, for example, this group calling themselves the Real 48%, sending death threats to Tory right-wingers. I believe that Andrea Leadsom received one today. Zach Goldsmith has previously tweeted that a constituent of his received one. These are things that what worried me was I saw Harriet Harman tweet, "This is a disgrace, this shouldn't happen to Andrea Leadsom." And left-wingers in her Twitter replies were saying, "Oh, it's only Andrea Leadsom," or, "Oh, I don't believe this is real." If you don't believe it's real on your own side, if you don't call it out on your own side, that's how the norms get moved. It's very easy for me to stand here and say the Tories are bad and wrong and shouldn't allow this, and Jacob Rees-Mogg is a terrible, terrible person. I have to say that about any Labour MP who behaves that way, because that's the braver thing for me to do. And that's the more important thing for all of us to do. Nick, I mean, I know that you've taken a lot of quite sort of counterintuitive stances within your party. Would you agree with that?
I mean, I suppose, of course, I mean, I have to say, of course, who wouldn't agree with what you both said? But I want to actually sort of, I think, talk about something that's more subtle, but actually more disturbing. And I think One of the main issues is the Brexiteers and the leading Brexit, the people who backed Brexit, they are just panicking and falling back on the campaigning rhetoric that they had before. Mm. I mean, they won. The 52% voted for Brexit. Brexit is happening. Soros is, whatever he's doing, it's not going to, you know, it's not going to work. Brexit is happening. But the real truth about Brexit, it's really, really complicated and it's really, really hard. And I spend some time in my professional life looking at certain aspects of Brexit. And whether you agree with it or not, extricating ourselves from how we've been building our economy and making our laws for the last 40 years is really complicated. Now, the Brexiteers like talking about World War II and quoting Churchill, but that's absolutely rubbish because this isn't a war situation. The best historical analogy I can think of is the fall of communism in the Soviet Union. Essentially, an old way of doing something has completely disappeared. And what happens? You need to replace it with something new. And if you don't, you have anarchy. Then people, during anarchy, certain things can happen and certain things can change. Now, the whole sort of shouting at civil servants for not doing their job right, the whole sort of having a go at George Soros for funding this group, which, not a lot of money from really when it comes to campaigning, a few £100,000, actually takes away from the fact that the Brexiteers haven't got to grips with delivering Brexit. You know, that's what they need to do. Mm. They need to stop all this campaigning and actually they need to realise they've won. And winning and having power and taking back control is all about actually having to make difficult decisions, difficult choices and deal with the reality. So while I agree completely with everything that you said, I think the most disturbing thing is actually how the Brexiteers and I hate to say the Conservative government themselves so far have yet to really engage with what Brexit means.
Absolutely. No, there's a line in Hamilton, which I saw the week before last, just pointing that out there. Winning's easy, son, governing's harder. And I just thought,
it is.
Oh, yeah. And that's exactly what you just said. And, I don't feel like I'm a staunch Remainer. I'm never not going to be a Remainer. The second we leave the EU, I'll be campaigning to get back in. Fine. That's my position. I realise that I'm on the extreme.
But that's great. That's fine. In democracy, that's great. People have different views and they campaign for different things. Exactly. Fine.
Exactly. But even where I less staunch, let's say I was on the fence somewhere and I would be like, oh, well, it's been done. Get on with it. My concern is I don't feel we currently have a team who are getting on with it in any way, neither in a... there are so many internal contradictions and the focus at the moment, I am sorry to say, seems to be the internal politics of the Conservative Party, not the good of the country. And that's just not a way for anyone. And, we saw this in the Labour Party, over Iraq, over things like that. It's not a good way to run a country. And it's very difficult because politics does get in the way of actually doing politics, if you see what I mean. But and that happens to everybody.
I think what you're saying is true, but I think the truth is that whoever was in power and however they were trying to execute Brexit, I think they would be hitting massive problems. And I know that a response to that could be, well, they just need to cleave as closely to the EU as possible and remain in EFTA, the EA and all of that stuff and, maintain freedom of movement. But fundamentally, we've got a massive problem here because almost half the country voted to remain and just over half the country voted to leave. There's a massive schism in the country. And there isn't really any way to resolve that.
Can I just come in just to add to your point? I mean, what people don't often mention is that during the snap general election that Theresa May called, the Conservatives ran very heavily on a sort of what some people have described as a hard Brexit ticket and best Brexit. And essentially, the country said, we're not sure about that as the form of Brexit. And so on top of the fact that, only 52% voted for Brexit, 48% voted for Remain. At the next general election, the majority of the country actually sort of said, we're not sure that this hard Brexit is what we want. And people, especially the Tory party, don't mention that.
But that's true.
Yeah.
That is true. But that puts into relief the massive constitutional problem that we now have, because the fact that the country voted in a referendum by a majority to leave, and that has been interpreted as kind of a hard form of Brexit, that seems to be where we where we are moving towards. And despite the fact that there has been a general election in the meantime that has left things much more muddy than that, given, as you rightly say, the Conservatives ran on a hard Brexit ticket and actually lost seats. The position of Corbyn in the Labour Party was pretty cleverly obfuscated as well. So it wasn't exactly clear what the country meant. But the referendum from 2016 still seems to be holding more sway than the general election result from 2017. Now, in our constitutional system, it's very unclear as to whether that's correct or not, because we don't really have any rules about how referenda are supposed to be interpreted. This one wasn't even binding, but realistically, politically, it has to be executed. You can't just shrug your shoulders and say, well, it wasn't binding, hard luck, because that's not how it was sold during the campaign itself. But I just wonder how long this writ runs for. 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, at what point?
Mark, you're correct in rhetoric, but actually in action, if you look at it, the government still isn't really clear about what Brexit means, and Parliament itself is still looking over it. So while in rhetoric, yes, there's still lots of hard language, the reality is, that there's a big muddle happening.
Yeah, but also, as when we discussed this on a previous episode, didn't we, you know, should there be another referendum? I mean, I'm highly sceptical about that, because I just think that would leave us in an even worse mess. I just think we're in an absolute mess, and I can't really see how we get out of it. But I also don't think any government could really resolve this. So to come back to my original point and what I was responding to Emma about, I think it's almost a little bit unfair to blame the Tories for this. Okay, it was Cameron and it was the Tories that gave us the referendum in the first place. These problems have been running like a running sore through this country for 25, 30 years. In the end, although I think it was a very big error that Cameron did here, I think in the end we would have had a referendum. Even the Lib Dems were saying, yes, we need a referendum, we need to settle this issue. You know, at some point we did need some kind of either a referendum or some big constitutional convention or something to settle this, because I think it was largely down to a load of nonsense in the right-wing press over decades and decades and decades. But there are millions of people, and it was obvious even before the referendum, there were millions of people in this country who were very, very, very unhappy with the EU or what was going on in politics more broadly. And I don't think you can just blame the Tories for this. It isn't just the Tories' fault.
Yes, it is. David Cameron called the damn thing. And do you think, in all honesty, that Brexit is settled, that we've made the decision, and everyone's like, oh, well, that's a decision then. I mean, just look at NAFTA in the States. NAFTA went through in 1992. It is still a highly live, relevant election issue. If you think we're not going to still be arguing about how Brexit screwed us over in 20 years, then you're a bloody cockeyed optimist.
No, I don't think it's settled, and I don't think it will be settled for generations, but the referendum has settled it for this generation. I don't think we can have more referendums,
because I ain't settled.
Okay, now what's the difference between 1975 and 2016? Because that was the gap between the last two referendums.
Yeah, but things move quicker now.
That's the kind of time frame I'm talking about.
I'm a better campaigner than they are. I'll get my decision much better, much quicker.
Good luck.
The Brexiteers are pretty good campaigners. You have to give them that.
No, they won. That doesn't make them good campaigners. It took them 35 years. I'll get a second decision much quicker than that. Just watch me. Just call me Peter Bone.
Okay, pleasure. You just described me as a pop-eyed optimist, Emma. Right back at you.
I am absolutely convinced of is that this ain't the end of the story. Whether we do get a second bite at the cherry within the next 5, 10, 15 years, whatever, it ain't going away. It ain't settled. You did not settle this. You do not settle things with divisive referendums. Ask our Scottish friends. You know, it is the worst possible way of saying that we will make a decision, because it doesn't make a decision. It splits countries. And we are now a very, very divided country, a country where people genuinely fall out. Families fall out over this stuff. I've got friends who've fallen out with family members over this. You know, it is very real and very serious and is not going to go anywhere anytime soon. And I ain't given up talking about it. And I'm also not going to give up blaming the people who did it to us, which is a weird fanatic gang with the Tories who turned it from a top 20 issue to a number one issue.
I mean, Emma, can I ask you a question, though? Because one thing thing I don't understand is why anyone could be so passionate about rejoining the EU. I mean, it's basically a bureaucratic trading bloc, which has its faults and its good parts as well. You know, I mean, the decision's been made. Why don't we just why don't we just try and make the best of it? Let's see where we go, because it could actually be the right decision. We don't know. I don't understand this sort of placing our whole identity in joining the EU again.
I don't place my whole identity in joining the EU. I place a part of my identity in being European, and I will not have that taken away by you or anybody. Nobody.
Being European and being part of the EU is not the same thing at all.
It is for me, and it is for all those people who voted not to be European. If you don't understand my passion, then you don't understand theirs either.
Emma, you're speaking to two of them. Both me and Nick voted to remain, but we don't feel the same level of passion as you do.
So?
And not everyone who voted to remain.
Well, I was asking you why, Emma.
But my passion is no less valid than a Brexiteer's. That's what I'm saying. My passion about being European is no less valid than some mad head-banging European. And yet they get everything they want and I get told, no, you don't matter. You don't count. Your passion, the reasons you care about this don't matter and don't count. Your neighbours whose families are being separated don't matter and don't count.
Emma,
they matter
you
to
are
me.
Definitely as valid as a mad banging Brexiteer. You are your opinion is definitely as valid as Peter Bones.
I know you think that's funny, mate, but Peter Bones is the one who's getting his own way and I'm not, so wait until I do.
Now, can I buy tickets for that fight?
Mate, I'll scratch his eyes out with my European flag.
That's how we should settle it, or what Brexit position we have should be done on SmackDown.
Well, I think what this last little exchange has just highlighted, though, is something very important. And I described this as a kind of binary split earlier on, but actually there are however many shades of grey in this. Just stretching all the way from people who feel as strongly as Emma does on the Remain side to the people like Peter Bone on the Leave side. And most people are somewhere in the muddy middle. I mean, when I voted, I voted to Remain, and I thought we were going to vote to Remain. But to be honest, I wasn't massively passionate about it. I thought we should stay, and I thought it would be a bit of a risk for us to leave. And I didn't like the tone of the Leave campaign either. So there were various reasons why I voted to Remain. And I was disappointed that we voted to leave. And I am worried about what's going to happen in the future. But to be honest, I wasn't as passionate about this referendum as I was about the AV referendum. I actually went out on the streets and tried to persuade the people.
We're on about 40 minutes for Mark mentioning voting reform, Emma, by the way, for those of our listeners who are running the sweepstake of when Mark mentions voting reform in the podcast, it's around about 40 minutes.
I'm definitely getting the alarm.
I mentioned AV. AV, as we all know, is not proportional, so I didn't mention proportional representation.
I think it's a signal voting reform alarm, Mark.
The reason I'm drawing the parallel, actually, I wasn't as passionate about this as I am about some other issues. But on balance, I thought we should remain. I think, actually, I'm in the majority among the people who voted to remain. I think most people who voted to remain did so as a kind of like, a bit of a Jeremy Corbyn kind of 7 out of 10 type thing where, yeah, we probably should stay in, but, you know, it's not a great organisation, but it's better than leaving. I think most people felt like that.
But I think that's probably true on the Leave side as well. I don't think that everybody who voted for Leave is as passionate about it. And yet we are painted that every single one of those 52% are hard Brexiteers that were out of absolutely everything and that's what they definitely knew they were voting for.
And that's utterly preposterous as well.
Absolutely. Okay, so I think we've probably spent our Brexit passions for the week. So I think we probably need to touch on, well, I mean, from one form of internationalism to another, the scandal at Oxfam that's been unfolding over the last few days and really important expose by the Times. For anyone who doesn't know, it's been revealed that certain aid workers working for Oxfam in Haiti and possibly other places I've heard Chad mention too were found to be both using prostitutes and possibly abusing beneficiaries of the work that Oxfam was supposed to be doing in those areas. Obviously, this is an utter and complete disgrace. These people are in positions of enormous trust. And there's been some attempts to justify this with, oh, they're under such pressure, blah, blah, blah.
other attempts to tie this to wider political concerns. Why are we giving the aid budget to these organisations if they're so dreadful? But I think ultimately, this is just a terrible, terrible failing. What can and should be done to make sure this doesn't happen again? Nick?
Well, this is an absolute case of systematic failure. I mean, I hate to say it, but it's been an open secret for many years that certain people who have gone to places to deliver aid, or UN forces, there have been elements within this who've done this. And I was talking to somebody on Sunday just at a random event who worked for a big organisation who got caught up in the blowback from Oxfam, and they were saying that when they were out there, they were sitting in meetings with people who they knew in the evening had basically, being what we would consider to be child prostitutes and all this sort of stuff. And I think to be honest, it's good that it's been exposed properly, because I think a lot of people knew about it. And one of the criticisms of the sort of Me Too movement and the Harvey Weinstein thing when it first came out was that actually it focused very much on, obviously abuse, but abuse of similarly or less, but similarly well-off people. There was little talk about the exploitation, the pressure that happens a lot lower down. I don't Oxfam do a hell of a lot of good work. There's a lot of people who do a lot of good work in there. I definitely don't think that they should have their funding withdrawn and taken away, because that's an extreme reaction. But what I think they and others should do is really up their game on what I call safeguarding, making sure something like this should not ever happen again.
Absolutely. Mark, any thoughts?
Yes, I have lots of thoughts. The echoes of what we heard with, say, like Jimmy Savile in the BBC, not just Jimmy Savile, but quite a few people with the whole yew tree thing with the BBC, but obviously Jimmy Savile in hospitals as well. If you think about the kind of things that were said in the aftermath of all of that, when that started to come out, that he was very powerful, he was in a position of authority, and lots of people respected him, and he was just allowed to run rampant whatever he wanted to do. And you hear this sort of thing again and again when there's big power disparities between people, that these things happen. And also the kind of everyone knew, there's kind of a nod and a wink, and she might have been underage, and she might have been in his caravan, but nod, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Savile even alluded to some of the stuff he was getting up to in his own autobiography. Mm. It was, he was hiding in plain sight. And it sounds like, from what I've heard about this, that again, it was kind of tacitly understood that this sort of thing was going on. And I think it is very important that this stuff comes out. As to what you do about it, people who want to abuse will always find ways. If you look at the Catholic Church, if you look at, situations where paedophiles inveigle themselves into local children's groups and things like that. And in this case, it really shouldn't surprise us that people who want to use child prostitutes abroad, or prostitutes more generally, find ways of getting into organizations that will allow them to do that and allow them to get away with it. And it is incumbent upon these organizations like Oxfam, because I'm sure it's not just Oxfam. All the headlines and all the stories have been about Oxfam. But again, like with Harvey Weinstein, it wasn't just Harvey Weinstein, and it won't just be Oxfam either. All of these organizations do need to do more. The point of these organizations is to help the areas that they're going to and the people who live in those areas, not to compound things with stuff like this. It is shocking.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for me, there are two key areas that we need to unpack. The first, there was a dreadful piece published by The Guardian today, which was, we need to talk about aid workers' sexual needs. I'm sorry, but the problem with the whole article is the idea that you have a right to have somebody else involved in your orgasm. Now, we generally want that. Generally, we don't want to have to rely on masturbation. I may have to put a 18 rating on this podcast, but I'm going to go ahead and make this point.
What's going to happen now?
You're really using the word masturbation.
The Harvey Weinstein point and this point is that nobody has a right to sex.
Nobody has a right to sex. No one can make demands of sex from people who don't want to give it to them. And, you know, we can talk probably another time because we haven't got enough time left about whether prostitution is coercion, whether prostitution can ever involve consent, because that is a deeply difficult and complicated debate. But when you're talking about the imbalance of power between aid workers and brothel workers in Haiti, there is just simply no way that you can justify that. And those people felt they had a right. Those people felt they had a right to have somebody else give them orgasms, and they don't.
No, I agree, Emma. I agree. I mean, at the very baseline, you shouldn't be involved in activity which is legal in your own country. So, for example, obviously, you go to a situation, let's take Haiti, where there's a terrible situation, there's a lot of poverty. I mean, you know, the idea that a 12-year-old is giving consent if you give them money to form sexual, it's just absolute nonsense, because that person is in a real desperate situation, their family is in a real desperate situation, and what you are doing is you're completely exploiting and taking advantage of that. And, of course, you know, everyone has needs and everyone, you know, tries to satisfy them in the ways that they want to satisfy. That's okay. But, you know what's wrong or right. And if you're stepping outside the boundaries that's acceptable in your society.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it has to start with that recognition in all of us. And nobody likes being knocked back, let's face it. But we have to recognise that we don't have a right to demand or pay for somebody else's consent without their actually giving it freely. And so that was my first point. My second point is that there is something going very, very badly wrong with the oversight of charities. And we have seen, as Mark mentioned, Jimmy Savile and the way that he was allowed to get into a number of different organisations. I'm thinking of the hospital that he was very, very heavily involved in. But yeah, in a non-sexual abuse, but still dreadful abuse of charity aims, look at Kids Company and the way that one charismatic person was allowed to absolutely make that a terrible disaster that then let down a whole load of vulnerable young people. There is something going wrong with how easy it is to set up a charity and how easy it is to pretend that you have oversight when you don't in charities. And I think the Charity Commission have got very, very serious questions to answer here, not least the fact that the first time that whistleblower went to them, she was turned away.
Yeah, I agree.
So I think, you know, if we're going to have a quangocracy, and we may all agree or disagree on what level of that involvement that should be.
I disagree with a quangocracy, but yes.
Yeah, if we're going to have one, let's have one that does the job it's supposed to do. So I think on that bombshell, with us dismissing the Charity Commission, I think we'll probably leave it there for a week. We've been chatting for quite some time. Anything else that you'd like? Any final words, guys?
No, I'm good. I think we've sorted it all out.
We have. I'm actually thinking of having a cheese sandwich. So I'm quite happy to end the conversation.
Is it English cheese or French cheese, Nick?
Yeah, no, it's cheddar. It's English cheese. Only because I don't have any French cheese in the house. But
I'm going to go and wrap myself in the EU flag. And apparently
I bet you've got an EU flag duvet.
I have a very nice checkerboard pink duvet, which is more girly than I ever knew I was. There you go. On that bombshell.
It's a bombshell. That is a bombshell.
That is a bombshell. Thanks, guys. Once again, you've been listening to Emma Burnell, Nick Dennis and Mark Thompson. We will be back in 2 weeks' time. We'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for the theme music. And this has been a Political Human production.